podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donny review system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Hi, Mike. Good to see you. Straight off the bat, just to be clear, you know, you and I have worked together a long time. If you want to call it to, some might say too long. If you want to call a timeout, at any stage in the next 3 or 4 minutes, that is going to change the whole dynamic of the rest of the show. I will move from a very relaxed and calm and composed and a position of togetherness to an aggressive and okay, it's game on then. So just to throw that out straight off the bat,
gotcha.
Think carefully about that. What on earth was he thinking, Mike? I mean, or are you buying into that at all? Do you think that the Raiders' mindset changed when that timeout was called?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that that's what they were going to do. And it actually makes a certain amount of comic sense that someone might say that to another player after the game. I think they would have settled for the tie, but it was the 10-yard run that changed. When Jacobs got that 10-yard run, that changed their perspective, I think. They might well have
said they got the 10-yard run after the timeout.
Yeah, but that, you know, I just think Staley, it's hard. I mean, you don't know. It would have been very cool for them to knock the Steelers out by tying, because that would be a once in a lifetime kind of opportunity. On the other hand, Raiders Chargers is a long rivalry, and you get a certain amount of frisson out of beating your old rivals. Mm. I really didn't give it a whole lot of thought. It's not something that matters so much in the big term. And whenever a Carlson gets to win the game in the last second, I love that.
The Iceman Carlson. I love that underrated player. And then some, and that was the story of the game really from the Raiders' point of view, wasn't it? That to the most part, the big game players that needed to stepped up and played at the height of their games. Crosby, obviously. Carr had some clutch throws, particularly in overtime. Jacobs, of course, you mentioned that breakoff run, and Carlson as well. So that's very, very much the tale of that game. But I still can't get a hold of I really feel strongly that the change in trajectory, I know we'll never know, and because it was such a surreal chain of events. And maybe it's because I was, you know, watching it at 4:45 in the morning and was heavily influenced by our old friends, Al and Chris. But I really felt, and Carr was playfully throwing petrol on it afterwards, wasn't he? But I really felt that they would have probably winked and nudged and taken the tie, and then timeout called, and that was game on. But we shall never know.
To me, the Chargers got a couple of really bad breaks. And, you know, Storm Norton was an Alliance of American Football player, you know, who's having trouble in the starting line. They moved him inside, and he picked up the worst penalty call of the weekend, and a weekend loaded with bad penalty calls, you know, for being ineligible downfield.
Yeah.
He had gone downfield with a block, and when the guy fell down, he just turned and blocked somebody else. He was nothing to do with the play. It was an unnecessary. And then when you see Mike Williams getting mugged in the end zone, you know, and still making catches, it was a good defensive game plan by Las Vegas, but Herbert and Mike Williams in particular really stepped up. They can't stop the run. They don't run the ball that well themselves. That's what really killed the Chargers in the end.
Yeah, and some questionable play calling as well, which Staley is under.
Yeah, the fourth and one. I mean, I don't care about the timeout, but when you go on fourth and one, down three, with tons of time left, you know, on your own 18-yard line, give me a break. I mean, I don't care. I don't care if you're a human computer. Nothing in the world. You know, and there were some of the guys were saying, oh, yeah, we've got a better chance of winning. You know, be real. You know, look at the situation in the game.
I love that. It was what supercomputer is disagreeing with you vehemently wherever he is, whichever bar he's holed up.
I'm still way ahead of AccuScore. Well, I finally punked AccuScore into the closet.
That's all I care about. Hey, listen, Mike, breaking news, by the way. We've been nominated. The show's been nominated in the Sports Podcast Awards. How about that? On the Best NFL Show. And this is particularly nice, Edge. Thank you very much for the nomination, Sports Podcast Awards. But our listeners can vote. You can vote for your favorite pod, and that counts. It kind of like much like Pro Bowl voting, I guess. An element of it counts to see if we can so we can be
vote all you want, and then one guy in a closet somewhere makes the decision as to who got the most votes.
I like to think we're like the sort of seventh.
That's the way the NFL used to do their favorite announcer polls.
Was it Hub Arkush that would vote for it in a closet? Yeah. Anyway, listen. Please go vote,
and if you do go vote, vote for us.
Vote for us. Sports Podcast. Yeah, we need to get
those like Charlie Varick kind of work suits, coveralls.
Oh, nice.
Let's say Charlie Varick, Last of the Independents.
Oh, I like that. I think we should work with merch.
Great movie. If some of you haven't seen Charlie Varick, I recommend it highly. One of the great 70s crime films.
Well, producer Ollie won't have seen it because it was made before the year 2017. So watch anything before that point. Anyway, sportspodcastawards.com. Head on over. The different categories in there, football, blah, blah, blah. NFL is where we are, or American football, they've written as. And vote for us. We would massively appreciate that. All right. Let's talk Black Monday. Michael, Black Sunday, if you're
can I just get in one more play? Tom Kennedy to Khalif Raymond.
Oh, Tom Kennedy, what a
Dan Campbell's never give up, bite their legs off, whatever kind of thing. Yeah, two guys from New England, D2 colleges in New England, or 1AA, I guess, nowadays. Holy Cross for Khalif Raymond, Bryant College in Rhode Island for Tom Kennedy. Tom Kennedy was a lacrosse player.
Yes,
another one of my favorite guys. I don't think he'd played much during the season, but he's probably in the running to be starting quarterback next year.
He's definitely on the short list. I was doing the radio show with Ben Isaacs, our friend Ben, of course, who is, as you well know, and as our listeners well know, there's nothing about the college game he doesn't know, Ben Isaacs, quite frankly. He looked absolutely black when I said to him, Tom Kennedy, what can you tell me about, playfully, because I knew you had no idea where he was. So then Ben can get very serious and studious and refused to talk to me for a few minutes as he was deep diving into Google. And then
he knows how to use Google.
He knows how to use Google, exactly. And he dug out the Tom Kennedy lacrosse breaking.
Yeah, he actually played for the Boston Cannons.
That's right. So Ben told me that very fact. At the moment he was telling me, I thought, I'm
amazed that the Patriots somehow missed him.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Two things in life that I am confused by. Cordero Patterson, why he isn't still a Patriot and a fundamental part of that offense. And Tom Kennedy isn't a Patriot right now. Right. Let's speak of things that are baffling me at the moment. And it's not a high bar, admittedly, I might. What on earth are Miami doing with Brian Flores in that?
Brian Flores today must feel like Brandon Bolden did when he got that flag for not hitting the guy on the fake punt for unnecessary almost roughness.
So the book is that it's him and Greer just couldn't see eye to eye.
Well, you remember we talked about this early in the year when I talked, I mentioned that the strange thing to me was that they had let Kyle Van Noy and Ted Karras go, who were some of the Patriots. I think they opened the training camp this year with about 10 ex-Patriots on the roster. But they let those two go for cap reasons, and they had a plan in place that would replace them. But I said at that point, right now, to replace Van Noy, they'll need two guys, because Van Noy is one of those all-purpose linebackers you can leave in on for three downs on every series. And it took them, it seemed to me, about half the season to figure out how that defense was going to work with the new. And it was good by the end of the season, very good defense. But at that point, it seemed to me as well that there was a disconnect at the beginning of the season between Greer and Flores. Mm. And the owner obviously was coming down on Greer's side. Now, I don't know whether this was fallout from Deshaun Watson versus Tua, which, you remember, Ross really wanted Deshaun Watson, really wanted. I mean, he was leaking it all over the place, whether it was fallout from something else. But obviously, taking that team back up to 9-8, beating the Patriots twice, and Flores is now 4-2, I think, against Bill Belichick. Just wasn't enough. And to most of us, and you're a Dolphins fan, it looked like they had taken the right turn and were going in the right direction. And next season, you would have a lot to look forward to because there's still a couple of holes in the team and they could address them in the offseason.
Absolutely. If you think it's exactly right. If you think about the, and this is very much as Flores' MO from the beginning, right? In terms of his tenure as a Dolphins head coach, leave him wanting more, end strong, and that's very much how he started out. And that's obviously how the season went. And you're right. No ground game of any kind. Tua banged up at times and a sophomore quarterback having gone through a rookie season, which was fractious because of injury and other things as well. I think pretty much the only thing I never really saw, didn't agree with Flores on, and I've been a big advocate of his from the start, was the whole pinch hitting fits last season with Tua. Whichever way you cut that and say, well, Tua's a strong character and Tua, I think it's not different to like Mariota coming in and spelling for Carr. It's a totally different situation. I think that would have caused however strong minded you are, an element of doubt.
I kind of agree with you, but I kind of don't, because you can see this year, I think it helped Tua. Remember, he was raw. He was a very, very raw rookie quarterback. He hadn't played he was rusty as well as raw.
True.
And so at times, if you're going to win the game, you needed to go with someone else. And if you're going to avoid inculcating bad habits into Tua, you almost needed to go to someone else. Their offensive line still needs work, obviously. And Fitz is a great guy to have on a bad line, because he moves around, he takes hits, it doesn't seem to bother him, and whatever bad habits he has, it's an old dog who's not going to learn new tricks, they're in. So I understood that at the time. And I get that
point when you're talking about maybe a game or a phase of games, but in a game, in a certain situation, and not specifically a situation that lends itself favorably to the quarterback coming in, like Mariota to Carr start.
Yeah, put it this way. I don't think Tua was adversely affected personally by it.
Okay.
Based on what he did this season.
What he's done this season.
Maybe Greer or Ross were. Maybe they didn't like that. Maybe you can question Flores' coordinators, which they did already, when they got rid of Patrick Graham after one year on the defense.
Right.
There is some kind of disconnect between him and the front office, obviously. But the idea to me was that when you look through the whole of Belichick's assistants who've gone on to coach elsewhere, very few of them have been able to establish a culture, not the Patriots culture, which some of them have tried to do, but you can't do it if you're not Bill Belichick.
Oh, come on, Mike. Matt Patricia established it.
Yeah, exactly. That exact example. What was Matt Patricia's team's culture?
Dysfunction, disharmony.
Getting rid of anybody who criticized him or anybody who didn't, Patricia in Detroit, he walked in as if he were a really successful coach. Everything's going to be my way. Anyone who dissented was immediately out of town, including a couple of very good players who they could have used. He never kind of adjusted his game planning to the players that he had. But Flores came in and he, I thought, established a culture.
Yeah.
We're going to be building. We're building toward being this. And, he was willing to keep players who bought into the culture, let other ones go. Mm. As I said, I think there might be some disconnect between the players who were let go and the ones he wanted to let go. Mm. But what you saw from Miami was a team that really needed to find its feet at the start of the season. And once they did, they were headed in the right direction. They won 7 of the last 8 games, and admittedly not the toughest schedule in the world. But, you just play who you have to play.
Play who's in front of you. So I was thinking about this, Mike, in terms of the easier of the two to replace. And Stephen Ross, if it was this, you got to pick sides, which it appears to be, right? Because reports coming out that they were trying to reconcile, or at least they were trying to find common ground, commonality that they could, you'd have to be drinking buddies as GM and head coach, but you got to share the same broad vision, right? And clearly that's where they were fundamentally differing. And reports suggest that over the last 4 or 5 weeks, they were trying one last attempt at, we can work together and run this organization together. And clearly that didn't play out as they'd hoped, right? So Ross had to pick.
It's weird that he would, but it makes a certain amount of sense in that the inevitable thing for coaches who want to succeed or who start to succeed is to want total control.
Right.
And maybe that's the simple Great answer. Maybe Flores was just looking for more control.
More control.
And the idea that he and Chris Greer could work together was kind of based on, in one sense, their mutual connection with New England.
Right.
Although Chris Greer's was fairly tenuous. It was his father, Bobby,
his dad.
You know,
yeah,
who was the GM. And I think Chris cast scouted for them for a year or two.
Parcells era, right? He was Bobby Greer was with Parcells.
Yeah. And the first, I think, Belichick year, maybe the first couple of years. Mm-hmm. But the same thing applies there. And that might be the simple answer. I think you might have put your finger on it right there. That Flores wanted more authority. Chris Greer didn't want to cede it. And Ross, in the end, went with Chris Greer. Mm. And if I can just guess or extrapolate further, Ross will have less trouble getting his way with the GM than he would with the coach.
With the coach. And to further to that, is it easier to, in the current climate, and not specifically Miami, but is it easier to replace a head coach than it is a GM? In the same way that running backs, they're an antenna. Yeah,
well, it's a tricky situation, which would lead us, you know, into Black Monday pretty nicely, the rest of Black Monday, because if you have a GM in situ, certain coaches are probably not going to want to go there.
Right.
You go into the job understanding that the GM is the GM and he's buying the groceries and you're cooking the meal, to use the Bill Parcells analogy.
But isn't there a risk to just on that, if you're going into a situation where the GM hasn't been established and you're the first man in, is the implication that you will have a significant say or at least input in who the GM's going to be, as opposed to you could be coupled with somebody that it's a disaster. It's better than the devil you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, and there are some guys out there who will want to handpick their own GM. If someone hires Jim Harbaugh, for example, he's going to handpick his GM, because remember, he lost one of these battles in San Francisco.
Right.
And he was even much more successful than Flores had been. And, you know, they had to choose basically between him and Trent Baalke, and they chose Baalke, and the franchise had a tough few years.
That went well. Can you see Harbaugh coming back?
Yes, I think I can.
Chicago?
I think he played in Chicago.
Right.
It would be one, again, the GM thing would have to be worked out. And you know, I'm not sure where the whole Phillips and ownership thing lies in terms of who the GM is going to report to. They're making noise like they want to hire a GM first and then go on a coaching search. Oakland would be a place. Sorry, I keep saying Oakland. Las Vegas might be a place for him. Given that he coached at Stanford, and we're still thinking of Vegas as being one of the San Francisco suburbs, as long as the Raiders are there, it would be a pretty good situation to go into. I think Vegas is attractive in a lot of ways in terms of the roster they have.
What could Rich do anything in? Well, obviously with the Super Bowl, but I mean, what if Rich plays tough and go down? We'll talk about the game in a bit. They're going to swing into the Bengals. Is that
if
enough?
If they win this week, the case for firing him is going to be very difficult to make.
What if they play him hard? So they made the playoffs.
That's going to be a tough one. What will they argue? They put together a pretty good team. It was in chaos. Rich steadied the ship, as it were. Can he take them the next step forward? That's going to be the question. Will a new coach come in and keep him as the special teams coordinator? But I'm sure there'll be a market for him.
That would be awkward. I think he did that.
No matter what they do. I think Denver's probably not as good a landing spot as some people think it is.
I disagree.
They're a pretty solid team. But the idea that they just need a quarterback to be a top winning team, I'm not totally convinced by that.
They're probably
the best of those six teams that need coaches, though.
The best game in terms of how complete they are at the moment.
Yeah, in terms of roster strength. And I mean, the thing is, you know, this is one of those. Has John Elway lured Aaron Rodgers to come there? Although if I were Aaron Rodgers, apart from probably wanting to prove something to somebody, there's not much reason, you know. Maybe if Green Bay falter in the playoffs again, you want to give it another shot with another team.
Yeah, but,
you
know, if he wins
you
all,
go then. 13-3 for three consecutive years.
MVP back to back.
Or 13-3.5 in three in the third in this last year because they were going to win that game until AR sat down, basically.
You know, on the Broncos emote, the course, the dream for Broncos fans anyway would be if they're available, Russell Wilson or Aaron Rodgers, right? But what about a level or two below, but a quarterback that would represent an upgrade, like for example, a Jimmy Garoppolo kind of type?
Garoppolo would be a nice fit in Denver, I think, for the kind of stuff they want to do. The one that the move that intrigues me the most, well, there's two actually. Russell Wilson to New York. To the Giants. I don't know what you do with Danny Jones, but maybe trade him along with, you know, they've got two first round picks. Or they could, the Jets could always trade Zach Wilson and then they wouldn't have to change Russell Wilson's jersey. They could just have Wilson on the back. They could save some money that way.
That's a great idea.
But the one that really excites me when I think about it is Russell Wilson to Pittsburgh to replace Ben.
I don't know
what Pittsburgh could give them. in return, but that would be to me a kind of perfect fit of Wilson and Mike Tomlin on the sidelines.
What a partnership that would be. Wilson to the Giants? I can't, because they're gonna, a player like that's gonna want to go to a contender or near contender, right?
I suspect the Giants still think Danny is their quarterback of the future.
Is Joe Judge their coach of the future? Because he is. Monday, but
they said so. They said so. They specifically said so. And you know, Gettleman's assistant is going to likely be the new GM. So nothing's going to change.
Nothing's going to change.
Which means nothing's going to change. Iron Mike, wisdom of the day.
Yeah, hot take, Mike. With Mike Zimmer and the Vikings, I was thinking about his collective tenure there, right? And it reminds me, or it was similar to the Kirk Cousins era and Kirk Cousins as a quarterback, good but not good enough. That's kind of how I viewed that. Is that a fair call?
I think so. And you know, he is what he is defensively, and it's very good. It can be, you can get around it. Remember this year they didn't have Adam Thielen for most of the year, and that changed the nature of their offense considerably. But they've really been undermanned on the offensive line for a long time. And he hasn't seemed to worry that much about it. His offensive coordinating choices have been kind of strange in a sense. His son is, you know, it's another nepotistic organization, but his son is one of the defensive coordinators. But you know, I think that's a fair judgment. Good, but not great. And his seasons, he averages out to a 9-7 record. Now the last 2 years brought that down, but you know, and then you're starting to hear this kind of my way or the highway business. You know, and that's
what happened to North, wasn't it? North got shown the door.
Yeah. But that's one of those things. And it's less true in football, I think, than in some sports, because it's harder to change, but basically hard-nosed coaches wear out their welcome eventually. Bill Parcells is a good example of that. There's no coach I think ever who's been better at a one-year turnaround with a team than Bill Parcells, coming in, knowing what he wants, turning a team around, building it within a couple of 3 years to being a contender, but then you start to wear out your welcome, especially if you're not winning the big, you know, the big enchilada. So
Lex and then Ryan, would you have someone Rex in that group?
Pardon me?
We'd have Rex Ryan in that group as well. That's kind of
in a different sort of way, but Rex almost wears himself out. but everyone gets tired of the blowhard shtick. But then you bring in an easy rider kind of coach, a guy who's going to keep everybody happy and on the same page. And then they eventually get taken advantage of, more or less. And then you bring in another ass kicker. You can see it in other sports a bit. Baseball's notorious for it because with the long season and, you know, the winning and losing that every team has during the season, it's not kind of you have to win every day. business, it becomes more evident who the guys who are glorified cruise directors are. And that can work in baseball. You know,
sure.
I think Casey Stengel said the key to managing is keeping the two guys who hate you away from the 12 who aren't decided.
I can just on a slight tangent, but a connected one nevertheless. Mike Carlson is a cruise director. What if this is going to iron Mike Cruise?
A love boat.
What could we?
Bring me to Minnesota. Bring me to Minnesota.
You and Smoot. What
I get one of those white outfits, you know, like Gavin McLeod used to have.
I love it.
You know, and be the skipper.
And say goodbye to all the passengers and they were disembarking. What would be on the Carlson? What would be on the Carlson cruise? Well, the music. What would be your programming in terms of music?
No, it depends on how old the love boat customers are. If they're kind of my age, it would probably be a nice blend of jazz in one club and 60s music, you know, rock in the other. And if they were younger people, it'd be 50s rock. Because that's all they understand.
I love
three chords.
I love it.
No synthesizers.
There is a bar east of Dalston right now that is solely playing 50s rock. You realize I promise you that. On the Broncos and Vic Fangio, if we talk about Zimmer's overall record, despite dropping down the last couple of seasons for different reasons, Fangio never really got going, did he, as Broncos coach? Ends with a 19-30 record.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough situation when you're a defensive specialist and your general manager is giving you turkeys as quarterbacks. You know, you really would have to have somebody who's an exceptionally good offensive coordinator to help you out in those situations. I think Vic is what he is. He's, you know, I remember him back from the Philadelphia Stars era when it was the Jim Mora defenses that produced Don Capers and a couple of other coaches besides Fangio. But he's a really good defensive coordinator, really smart. And if he wants to keep coaching, I'm sure he'll get a defensive coordinator job somewhere because he literally is that good. But, you know, you just didn't get the sense that he was a head coach in command of the ship.
Yeah.
You know, that's always a bad proposition.
That's never a great attribute or otherwise to have as a head coach. Just two very quick points on questions for you, Mike, on this, and then we'll get into looking at the wildcard weekend. In terms of Flores, first of all, is there a possibility that he bounces straight into a head coaching gig at Jacksonville, maybe?
It's a possibility. I suggested that last night because I think that whole culture building thing is important for a young team. And I think that's what Shad Khan was thinking of in terms of Urban Meyer, but he didn't really think it through, or he got conned basically. that would be a good spot for him. Maybe looking at it. The problem is that when you look at Denver or Minnesota, you're losing defensive coaches. Mm. You don't necessarily want to bring another defensive coach in, you know, and I don't think culture is the thing in Vegas. I'm not sure about building culture in Vegas. So that leaves Chicago as the only other open job. And I think he'd be a good coach in Chicago, but I think they'll be looking for someone who's going to make more of a name. And then the question for Flores is, does he want to go as a defensive coordinator somewhere else?
Right. Sit out a season.
Or does he want to sit out a season or maybe even take a college? I don't know.
Yeah,
see what happens in colleges. The interesting thing is, I know Gerard Mayo is getting some looks.
Yeah,
I saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
If he were to go somewhere, I wonder if Flores would go back to New England as DC, would then set up a great succession battle. I mean, this is
McDaniel's v. Flores.
It's Shakespearean. Yeah. If McDaniel stays and if Flores were to come in and Steve Belichick remains like co-defensive coordinator or something like that, you'd have this amazing succession battle. It would be, you know, it would be Hard Knocks for a full year if you wanted. But, you know, maybe McDaniels, for example, could go back to Denver.
Mm.
He might not want to, but that would seem to be a place where they might look at him. And, you know, I was making the list of God, there's so many candidates.
That was the second question. So you fire away, Mike. I was going to ask you, who's on a Carlson's shortlist?
Well, my shortlist and the shortlist would be a different thing. So I think Eric Bieniemy is going to get interviews, and it would not surprise me if he didn't get hired again.
Do you think there is an argument here? And I know I get the whole, well, it's Andy Reid's shadow and everything else. But you mentioned Gerard Mayo, and he is obviously hasn't had a coordinator gig yet.
No.
So he was, involved in the interview process last year. I think he interviewed well
He had an interview, yeah.
So is there, and again, he'll get some more this time, even if he doesn't land the big gig, is there an argument that Bieniemy just isn't interviewing very well?
It's possible. I mean, we don't know that. I don't see a reason why he shouldn't be interviewing well, you know, from everything that I've heard and seen. I think the Andy Reid thing is part of it. The fact that he's an older assistant coach, you know, and now getting it, you're going to get your first head coaching gig. Fangio, for example, is an example of why teams shy away from that.
Yeah.
You know, there are ex-head coaches around if you're interested in going with that. You know, Peterson and Jim Caldwell kind of jump out at you.
Anthony Lynn is available.
Anthony Lynn's available, yeah. There's a bunch of good defensive coordinators, some of whom have head coaching. But I think Todd Bowles is due a second chance away from the Jets. Vance Joseph, maybe. Dennis Allen of the Saints.
Leslie Frazier, he's on the name in the
Leslie
Chicago.
Leslie Frazier's going to be, Vance Joseph's going to be in there. Aaron Glenn is a young and up-and-comer as a coordinator, you know, kind of in the Mayo thing, but he has been a coordinator now. Eberfluss I liked last year, and I still think Eberfluss would make a good head coach. And Dan Quinn has come off a really good season with Dallas as a defensive coordinator.
Because Kellen Moore's getting a lot of hype, as we talked about on the show, but Quinn, had a more impressive season given what he's done with that personnel.
Moore's interesting. I think Moore would be better suited to stay in Dallas and become head coach. But I don't think Jerry Jones is going to fire Mike McCarthy and promote Moore. And McDaniels, obviously, teams will be looking at Bieniemy. The other coordinators I'm not excited about.
That's a fun list. Coordinators I'm not excited about.
Leftwich, you know, Jacksonville might look at him, but I don't think he's like Bieniemy. He's young. He will get a chance eventually, I think. But right now he's in a shadow in Tampa. People were talking about Kevin O'Connell, who you and I met when we were down in New England for preseason, when he was like a third round draft pick coming in for the
wasn't Jerry Mayo? I think Mayo might have been drafted that year as well, right? Was he like 2008? The summer of 2008 was Mayo.
2008. I think Mayo was already there. What's his name? Cable, the linebacker with the skinny legs, was there. You know, I'm not convinced.
Yeah, no, Mayo was drafted in 2008.
That was his year. Yeah. Okay. Well remembered.
God, time flies on Mike.
Steichen in Philadelphia, I've seen mentioned. Nathaniel Hackett, who
nice name.
I'm not convinced. Yeah, nice name there. Brian Daboll, I'm not convinced about head coaching ability. So, I mean, but the point is there's a lot of guys out there, you know, and unfortunately, Todd Haley got snapped up by the new USFL.
He's off that. He's out of the running. I am good at obsessive with this. I mean, you went Shakespearean. I'd say WWE three-way Flores, McDaniels, Belichick cage match, tables, chairs, and ladders. Whatever.
Yeah, one of my favorite little memes is that one where Belichick's coming out. I think it's in Detroit, and they play the Royal Rumble kind of it, where the glass is shattering and Belichick comes
Stone Cold's music.
Stone Cold music. Yeah. It's brilliant. You know?
That is great. Hey, we put out a Hogan Macho gif for the boys on social for our show today, the Mega Powers. And somebody said, we could battle to who does the best Macho Man. Oh, yeah. But somebody said, who's the Miss Elizabeth in this scenario? Which I think we should steer well clear of.
You mean on the MC show?
I guess that was the point, yeah.
If we only have one candidate, as far as I know.
Holly is the Miss Elizabeth.
That wasn't the one I had in mind, but there you go.
Let's get to, because we've got a lot of ground to cover, and speaking of the mailbag, we're going to get into that as well.
Yeah, let's cover that ground.
Let's start with the Raiders-Bengals, Mike. So, well, we talked about a number of the key Raiders protagonists stepping up against the Chargers. And that's going to be interesting, with whether Max Crosby can replicate that kind of wreckage against a Bengals line that you can get to Burrow, right? It's not exactly the line that Bengals fans would want to have.
I think you put your finger on one of the real keys. And, you know, Cincinnati won in Las Vegas, but the game wasn't as one-sided as it looked, because McPherson had that. He kicked like four field goals and three of them were over 50 yards. And, you know, the other one was 47, I think. So it was a closer game than you might think. The Bengals, though, have more weapons. And if they can spread the ball out to three receivers, it's going to force Oakland to adjust their coverage. And if they can't get the rush on Burrow, and Burrow's been pretty good at avoiding the rush, just as Herbert was. If it becomes a shootout, I mean, this is what I thought last week. I said, if it becomes a shootout, San Diego is going to beat Oakland, you know, old AFL kind of guy. But if this becomes a shootout, you'd have to think Cincinnati is going to win that one.
Right.
But they surprised us last week. They're 6.5 favorites. I think that's a little bit flattering to the Bengals, but the Bengals are at home. The weather might well be bad. I don't know. The U.S. is in turmoil right now, so... but I think the Bengals win this.
Stronger roster. The reasons you've just said, I think that if they get out into a lead, it's going to be hard for the Raiders to keep up in a shootout. But let's say they don't. Let's say the Raiders succeed in stifling and slowing that offense down. How does the flip side work in terms of Jacobs against this Bengals run defense? Renfrow, Waller is...
Well, that's the problem. And that's why I downgrade the Raiders in a sense, is they want to run and get into the lead and therefore control the game. And if they can't do that, they're in a bit of trouble because, I mean, Renfrow's had a brilliant season and, you know, and everybody, he's not getting much kind of love in terms of postseason accolades because he's Hunter Renfrow and he's sneaky fast. He's,
we've been showing him some love on this show, Mike.
He deserves some, but they're not going to game break you. You know, so you can sit in your zone defense and play to stop the run at the same time. And I think to me, that's what makes the difference between the two teams.
Okay. Pats Bills, intriguing because they've split them during the season. I'm hearing a logical and fairly prominent argument that if you give Belichick a third look at you in a season, even if, again, we're talking about a roster mismatch in terms of on paper talent, and I know that they're trending in different directions right now in terms of form, but if you give Belichick a third look at a team, it spells trouble. Are you buying into that?
In this case, I don't think it matters so much because he didn't need a third. He didn't need a first look. He knew what Buffalo is. Buffalo's not much different than they were last season or even the season before. Mm. And, you know, the key to stopping Buffalo's offense is to keep Josh Allen in the pocket and make him beat you as a pocket passer. And we all know this. And I don't think they're going to – the question is how well you do it. When they went up to Buffalo, they were helped by the elements, which rendered Josh Allen much less effective.
And I still think in that, Mike, I know he didn't throw much, but I still think he was throwing quite effectively in that game despite the elements. And there were a couple of strikes to Diggs in that game that were really on point.
Yeah, but not, you know, it was too difficult. And the Patriots were controlling the clock as well as the game. In the game in New England, Buffalo jumped off to a quick lead. And what we have seen in these losses to good teams, to Indianapolis and Buffalo and to Miami, who are not that good a team. I mean, I thought the Patriots probably were good. I knew they don't win in Miami. I said this last week. I said,
you did, yeah.
I still wound up in the end picking them.
Of course.
You know, but I shouldn't have, but I did.
Well, you got to give Akiskor a fighting chance, I guess.
Yeah, but that game changed on the pick six and on that call, you know, where they had Miami stopped. The call gave Miami a first down and they basically let the air out of their balloon for a couple of plays and then now all of a sudden you're down 17-0. They fought their way back in, but they're not a team that can score quickly. they haven't had many really big plays through the air all season. And that's going to be the problem against Buffalo, because it is tough to score on Buffalo, to score quickly on Buffalo. They play really good zone defense. They've been playing the same defense, you know, the whole McDermott era. You have to beat them underneath. So when you're in the lead with the Patriots, and this is what happened in Buffalo, they could do that. They didn't have to worry about taking anything above. But when you're chasing Buffalo, that's a bit harder. So I think absent a break for the Patriots, and they haven't made many breaks against good teams, I think this is probably a Buffalo's game to lose.
A lot of focus inevitably, because he's a quarterback and he's a rookie and he's a Patriots first round pick, which we don't see in the Belichick era, on Mac Jones and on the Patriots offense, and not really one outstanding player, but it was grinding and had its identity and effective. But defensively, Mike, which of course for much of the season, the defense was rolling and was very effective. I think you might've talked about this a little bit in recent weeks, but expand upon it, particularly based on in the context of the Dolphins game. What's going wrong with this Patriots defense? Why is it suddenly unraveling?
Well, all of a sudden they're shorthanded in the secondary, and the secondary is somewhat limited anyway. I mean, J.C. Jackson's a really good player and a ball hawking player, and those two are not necessarily the same thing. You know, the ability to be around the ball is a good, and make plays is a really good trait for defensive back, but if you're a gambling kind of guy, it can hurt your team as well, which I said, I think, about Diggs a few weeks ago. You know, you have to take the rough with the smooth. You saw it in the game with Miami when they called the penalty on Jalen Mills against Mac Hollins, eagle on eagle action. And, you know, it was the classic cheap interference call. The quarterback underthrows the ball. The receiver comes back for the ball. The defender gets in his way coming back for the ball, and they call interference on the
defender. Caught on the defender, yeah.
It was like Belichick. I haven't rarely seen Belichick so livid on the sidelines. Mm. He was on the field, you know, almost a minute later, still screaming at the officials. But Jalen Mills is 5'9".
Right.
Mac Hollins is 6'4", I think.
I can attest to that.
Miles Bryant. Yeah, Miles Bryant's 5'9", 5'10".
You know, so they're going to regret letting Gilmore go? Now they're in the playoffs and now they're in this matchup?
Probably not, because long-term, yes. I mean, short-term, you always would like to have Stephon Gilmore there. But, you know, long-term, they were going to lose him anyway. You know, they probably should have got more for him. But you have to learn to live, play without. J.C. Jackson, I think, is going to be a free agent again next year. And that's going to be more difficult for them to play. So when you're playing the Bills, they do have good receivers. You have to match up with all of their receivers, even COVID David, COVID Beasley.
Gabriel Davis
is a real good second, third receiver. You know, I like him a lot. Diggs is great, obviously. Knox is a good tight end. And they'll use the backs out of the backfield too. So,
well, yeah, Singletary's starting to roll as well, isn't he?
Yeah, and that will make all the difference if they can establish the run game against the Patriots in Buffalo. Their line didn't play well. And Bearmore might be out for New England. I haven't seen an injury report, but he was injured on the play where Tua went for the first down in the fourth quarter. And he's been a rookie sensation very quietly, because no one pays attention to the nose tackles unless they line up at fullback and catch passes.
And then they love him. Eagles, Bucks, I guess you can simply distill this down into the Eagles love to run. They have to run really with a quarterback like Jalen Hurts, who is not a particularly poised pocket passer, although they're trying to develop that side of his game, up against one of the best in the business in terms of stopping the run. So if that happens, is there any hope for the Philly Eagles?
That's nutshell. I think they're getting back, you know, the Bucks are getting back Shaq Barrett. Fournette, I think, is coming back. Levante David, I think, is back. They're going to be tougher for Hurts to kind of make up the difference in the running game, if that's what it's going to take. Now, Vita Vea might be slower carrying $75 million around with it.
You won't have it on the field, I doubt. Anyway, Mike, maybe really? On the sidelines in a wheelbarrow.
I wouldn't leave it in the locker room. but yeah, I think, you know, I don't see 8 points leading people to go over to take the Eagles in this one. And Brady, as you saw last week, Brady, you know, with something to prove, is still a tough nut to crack. Now, the Eagles have a good offensive line. That's going to be a great matchup. They have a good defensive front. You know, they've played much better defensively the last six games or so, which partly is due to when you can control the ball, your defense is more rested and can do well. So, you know, it should be an interesting game. But when they played the first time, the Bucs had like 40 to 20 time of possession, almost double the yardage. But the score was relatively close because the Bucs also had 120 yards in penalties in that game.
Wow.
I looked that one up.
Messy. Yeah. That is messy. All right. All right, Mike. Key things you are looking for in the Niners Cowboys.
This is the one I like. If there's going to be an upset, I kind of like the Niners to be the team that could create the upset. To do that, though, Dallas, one of the interesting things with Dallas and Dan Quinn is Dallas is a much better pass rushing team than any of Dan Quinn's Atlanta teams were. And they can come at you with about three different guys off the edge, including Micah Parsons. And Parsons will play inside as well. So I think that's the one area where they have the real edge. If they can pressure Jimmy Garoppolo, they might be able to turn the game around that way. The Niners have to be able to run the ball, which against Dallas will be a little bit easier than throwing the ball, I think. But to me, strangely enough, I think the Niners can keep that offense under control, but they're going to have a lot of trouble with their own offense.
What quickly on that, the 49ers secondary against the Cowboys offense, major mismatch, isn't it?
That's part of the problem. They do get pass rush. We'll see who's playing at tackle for Dallas. But San Francisco can be beaten in man coverage. And strangely enough, Cedric Wilson has been taking the top off of teams for the last couple of weeks, ever since Michael Gallup went out. And that has made C.D. Lamb, in particular, much more effective. Amari Cooper hasn't been much of a factor in that time. But, you know, I think Dallas, I mean, although I say San Francisco to me is good potentially for an upset, they're only getting 3 points if you're betting it that way. And I'd probably think that, you know, this is like a 6 point game or so. Mm.
Okay, Steelers Chiefs, surely there is no way that Roethlisberger can do it again, right? I mean, or is it going to be Najee Harris?
I'm not convinced. Yeah, I'm not convinced Ben did it as much as it was out there to be done.
He landed a few strikes in it, but I get you. There's a clear regression, you know, all season.
Yeah, I mean, I think the matchup to watch here is T.J. Watt against Andrew Wiley, who's now the right tackle. The Chiefs offensive line is a pretty good line, especially run blocking, which is why they've gone to the run. And that's going to be a strength against strength matchup.
Yeah.
Because, you know, TJ Watt gets all the publicity, but Cameron Hayward in particular, that front three for the Steelers is actually played really well this season. Schobert has played well. Jacksonville let him go for nothing. And he's played really well at inside linebacker, you know? So I think, for Pittsburgh, since they don't have, you know, if you're going to sort of be attacking Kansas City, you might want to go with their secondary, which is what we saw Cincinnati do quite successfully. They drew a bunch of flags, you know, as well as made some big plays. But who's Pittsburgh going to do that with? You know, they don't have a long passing game unless he catches you by surprise. With all the attention to Kyle Pitts, which is in most senses deserved. Pat Freiermuth. The Pittsburgh rookie tight end has been really good. And I really like him.
But yeah, 100%
on that. It was 36-10 when they met. When was that? Only a couple weeks ago, three weeks ago.
Yeah, December.
And that was a pretty fair reflection of the game. Kansas City didn't really play well.
Well, it was a mad game, wasn't it? They just blazed into a crazy lead at the half.
And yeah, then... and which is now what they do. They blaze into leads and then see if they can give them away. It reminds me of Jackie Kellogg, who played for the Niners and played in NFL Europe, telling me about practicing with Deion Sanders. He said they'd be practicing and Sanders would let the receiver get an extra step on him. And then an extra step after that, and then an extra step after that, just to see how much ground he could make up. And it drove the coaches crazy.
Oh, God, I bet. It's kind of like what you've been saying about Aaron Rodgers. He's just getting increasingly frustrated at how easy everything is, just nonchalantly sidearming it. All right, so that is looks like it should be a straightforward win for the Chiefs. What about the Cards-Rams? Maybe the toughest game of the weekend to pick, Mike, I think.
Yeah, I think if this is the other upset game. And you know, it's interesting that the three NFC West teams are all kind of in that position of playing games they can win in this one. Again, they split their season series. But to me, the thing is, the Rams were 7-1 when Robert Woods got hurt, and they're 5-4 the rest of the season. Mm. And Matt Stafford obviously has not had a great December. But I think part of that is teams concentrating on taking Cooper Kupp away. And it's not that Stafford's trying to force the ball to Cooper Kupp as much as he has to take extra time to find somebody else to get the ball to. When it's Kupp and Woods, he can go one way or the other. He doesn't have to think about it. But it looks to me like he's thinking about, can I trust this guy to make the catch? Do I want to throw the ball when he's tightly covered? You know, can he come through? Even if it's Van Jefferson, you know, it doesn't look like he has that level. And last week, they didn't go with the run game. But before that, for a few weeks, they were really stressing the run game. And Sony Michel had two or three games in a row where he had like 75 to 100 and something yards in each game.
Right.
And that changes the complexion of the game for the Rams. I think the Rams can hold Arizona's pass attack in control. The problem with teams like Arizona for the Rams is that their primary rush comes from the inside with Aaron Donald. And as with Josh Allen, the key to beating Kyler Murray, even more so, is to keep him in the pocket, because he can't see over the pocket. You know, he's got to move around in the pocket to get a good the Baker Mayfield syndrome, you could call it.
Yeah.
You know, and not, which is not putting Kyler Murray down.
No, sure. It's just a fact, right?
But it's a fact. And so I think that's going to be an interesting matchup. And again, it's one of those things where I don't know how you predict it. Sometimes you just say, look, they're going to be able to do this. But this is one of those games where it's like, well, if team A can do this and if team B can do that, they'll win. But, you know, can the other team stop them from doing that? The Arizona defense is very multiple in the sense Isaiah Simmons does flexible for them what Matthew did. And, you know, he can be all over the field and make plays in that sense. Mm. So they will probably be hoping to catch the Rams on one of those going for someone but Cooper Kupp plays and beat Stafford that way. I get the sense if the Rams lose this game, it'll be because Stafford turns the ball over.
Okay. Really good stuff, Ryan. Mike, as ever, catch the big man at Carlson Sports, patreon.com/FMTE. Before we go, though, you want to raise a glass to Don Maynard.
Yeah, Don Maynard passed away. For those of you who don't know, he's in the Hall of Fame. There's only two AFL receivers in the Hall of Fame, and Maynard was one of the 20 guys who played all 10 seasons in the AFL. Lance Allworth obviously was the best receiver in the AFL, but you could argue in the early years there was someone, but Maynard had the advantage of playing all 10 years and playing for the Jets when they won the Super Bowl, playing in New York. He was Joe Namath's deep target, not necessarily his favorite one all the time because he had George Sauer for a while, but he played in both the greatest game ever for the Colts. And then Weeb Eubank brought him in with the Jets after he'd played a year in Canada. So he played in the game where the Jets beat the Colts in the Super Bowl to establish the AFL as a real thing. He and Johnny Sample both did that. Maynard was great because he was a deep threat receiver in a league that didn't need deep threat receivers, one trick ponies, as it were. So that, which is why he only had that one season with the Colts back in the 50s. He also wore a single bar helmet for all of his career, which a lot of guys did in the 60s still, but his didn't have a chin strap. He's the only guy I can remember who didn't wear a chin strap. So he had this helmet sitting on his head with one bar and no chin strap. And you just thought every time he got tackled, you just waited for that thing to pop off like a pimple. But he had like extra ear padding or something to hold it on. And he was so easygoing and relaxed. So much a Texas kind of guy who just lived and breathed football. You know, he was graceful, low key, not a showboat. But a really effective player. And, you know, like I said, to me, there's other guys in the AFL receivers who might deserve to be in the Hall of Fame as well, but I wouldn't kick Don Maynard out by any means.
Don Maynard raising a glass and a fine way to wrap the show. Brilliant stuff, Iron Mike. Look after yourself, bro. We'll check in after the Wild Card Weekend Madness with you next week. Take care.
It's going to be Wild Card Weekend.
Podcast Network.